We'll hear argument now in the case of Benefiel against Anderson. Mr. Pritchard.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Gary Pritchard on behalf of the petitioner appellant, Bill Benefiel. I'd like to address two areas in my argument today. The first will be the competency issue, and the second will be the issues concerning the jury's and the judge's consideration of mitigation. With regard to the competency claim, due process prohibits the trial of an individual, of a defendant who is not competent to stand trial. And that standard applies both pre-trial as well as during the course of the trial. And if situations change during the course of the trial to indicate that an individual is incompetent or may be incompetent, case law is clear the court has an obligation to inquire into that. And that's precisely what happened in this case. Mr. Benefiel had two competency hearings before trial, and at the end of both of those hearings, the trial court judge found Mr. Benefiel competent to stand trial. During the course of trial, Mr. Benefiel testified, and as a result of that testimony, where he testified about his difficult upbringing and his history of mental illness, Mr. Benefiel had suffered a mental breakdown. And we know this because the evidence that was introduced in state court proceedings following his breakdown established that, and it was uncontroverted. Specifically, the evidence was uncontroverted that Mr. Benefiel does suffer from, did at that time suffer from a lifelong history of mental illness. Secondly, it was uncontested, the uncontested testimony both of Dr. Stewart and Benefiel's trial counsel, that Benefiel did in fact suffer this mental breakdown and it had a dramatic effect on him. Third, it was uncontested. The testimony of Dr. Stewart and his trial counsel were uncontested that as a result of that breakdown, Mr. Benefiel's already limited ability to consult with his attorney was markedly decreased. Finally, it was uncontested, the testimony of Dr. Stewart was uncontested, that Benefiel did not manufacture this breakdown. He wasn't malingering. Our position is, given that evidence, the state court's determination that Mr. Benefiel was competent to stand trial was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in state court proceedings. We believe that just on the evidence alone that was presented, that the state trial court's decision doesn't pass the test 2254D2. However, there's an additional factor here that plays in that we think even tips the scales even further, makes it clear that we're entitled to relief under 2254D2. And that is, the court didn't simply disregard the evidence, and he did do that, but he explained the reasons for doing so. And he cited to information that's not supported by the record. He made an erroneous assumption. Specifically, he stated, and this was after the breakdown, there was a difference of opinion here between Dr. Stewart and the other psychiatric people as to this line, whether he can make a decision to go into the courtroom or to participate and chooses not to, or his so-called inability. That was clearly erroneous. There was no evidence in the record to support that. The two other mental health experts who did testify, both obviously testified before Mr. Benefiel's breakdown, and the only expert testimony following Mr. Benefiel's breakdown was from Dr. Stewart.
You kept following the breakdown. At what point did he walked off and didn't come back? That's when the breakdown occurred?
I can't say the precise time, but as a result of testifying.
You keep referring to at the time of his breakdown, when the breakdown, and my question was fairly simple. When do you think it occurred?
When he completed his testimony that day, and then.
After that time, things were going along swimmingly, and when he refused to come back into the courtroom, that's when the breakdown occurred? Or is that your idea when the breakdown occurred?
It was that time period the breakdown occurred as a result of his testifying.
So when he testified, that's what broke him down?
Yes. I mean, on top of his lifelong history of mental illness, that stress of testifying caused this breakdown. And that was the testimony of Dr. Stewart.
The fact that he didn't want to face cross-examination is an indication of a breakdown?
No, the fact that in talking with Dr. Stewart's evaluation of him, he was markedly different. He wasn't able to answer questions. All he could focus on was I can't go back in that courtroom. I can't go back into that courtroom.
Any criminal defendant likes to face cross-examination or would prefer to say, I don't want to go back in that courtroom?
I imagine they probably would not want to face cross-examination.
Well, that wouldn't be a sign of mental illness. It would be a sign of intelligence.
It could be, and had the state called a mental health expert of its own to examine Mr. Benefield on this question, you know, perhaps the state could have brought in evidence to that effect. But the evidence in the record
is one of the things that is interesting about the insanity defense is that when witnesses are perfectly capable of evaluating, if the evaluation has to do with what occurred in the courtroom, why wouldn't the judge be a sufficient evaluator of what the hell is going on?
I don't think the evaluation is what happened in the courtroom. It wasn't, you know.
Well, he wouldn't come back in the courtroom. That fact was made known.
Yes, that's correct. But
and that's the predicate for the breakdown. That's when we decide he's now broken down.
Dr. Stewart, who was the mental health expert who evaluated it, did conclude that as a result of testifying, he did have this breakdown. He did. It changed him. He said if there was any question previously and there was a possibility that things were different now, that this was a markedly worse condition, he did not have the ability to consult with his trial counsel. And so, given that the trial court judge believed that there was evidence in the record, or you know, his statement, he refers to a difference of opinion about Mr. Benefield's ability to come back into the courtroom following his breakdown, that evidence simply is not in the record. And so because he based his determination in part upon this evidence that was not actually part of the record, Wiggins v. Smith makes clear that we've satisfied our burden and that the trial court's decision here was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in the state court proceedings. Other information that the state trial court judge relied upon in reaching his conclusion, as we explained in our brief, maintained was irrelevant. On the facts of this case, irrelevant. And that is the judge's observation that at one point prior to the breakdown, Mr. Benefield was seen speaking with his attorney, by itself says nothing about his competency following this breakdown after this change in circumstance. Again, hypothetically, pre-breakdown evidence is not, per se irrelevant, but it is on the facts of his case because there was nothing introduced in the record. There was nothing in the record that would have linked his condition previously, to take the position that, he spoke with his attorney previously, we had a mental health expert evaluate him who said, his condition is the same as it was previously, so the fact that he was able to consult with his attorney previously, could be tied to and become relevant. But here, the uncontroverted evidence from the mental health expert and from his trial counsel was that he was not, as a result of his breakdown, he was not competent to stand trial. It's been, the state argues in the brief and the district court also in its decision took the position that notwithstanding that the evidence that's introduced, that the state trial court judge was free to disregard that evidence. And our position is the cases that we're aware of don't stand for that proposition. In the cases such as Maggio v. Fulford and Bryson v. Ward, there was something in the record upon which the court could base its decision to disregard the testimony. For example, in Maggio, the expert opinion there, a fundamental premise to it was the belief that the the defendant had not provided the names of alibi witnesses to his attorney, when in fact, in the state trial court, you know, made this finding, and the U.S. Supreme Court focused on it as well. In fact, that was not an accurate assumption. So there was a basis in the record to say, I'm going to disregard the testimony. Again, here, there's absolutely no basis in the record to disregard the testimony of Dr. Stewart. And then, again, as an additional matter, getting back to the 2254 D2 issue, even if hypothetically, or even assuming for sake of argument that state trial court could disregard uncontroverted evidence of incompetency, our position is Wiggins makes clear that if the basis for doing so is reliance upon evidence that's not part of the record, that evidence that has no support in the record, that turns this into an unreasonable determination of the facts. That concludes my argument on the competency issue. There are no other questions. I'd like to move on to the mitigation issue. It's the bedrock principle of the Eighth Amendment, Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, that a sentencer must consider and give effect to any relevant evidence offered by a defendant as mitigation. And a corollary to this principle is that it violates the Eighth Amendment to preclude the sentencer from considering and giving effect to evidence that a defendant proffers as mitigation. And in this case, there was a great deal of evidence introduced, largely at trial, but it was referred to in the sentencing proceeding, but also evidence introduced at the sentencing proceeding regarding Mr. Benefield's nightmarish background, his lifelong history of mental problems, and unfortunately, the state trial court here believed as a matter of law that, quote, mitigating is defined as a fact or circumstance which makes an offense appear less severe. And we know that's what he believed because he instructed the jury to that effect. And our position is that that's an unconstitutionally narrow definition of mitigation, and it's focused on evidence or fact or circumstance pertaining to the offense. We can see this was a pretty horrible offense, and this limiting instruction basically made it impossible for Mr. Benefield to overcome the death penalty because it was mitigating evidence. You know, it's not going to make the offense less severe. It's going to go to his background and result in mercy or in sympathy from the sentence arising out of the evidence of his nightmarish background. So we know that the judge had a unconstitutionally narrow understanding of what mitigation was, and we also know that he applied that narrow definition in evaluating the evidence. And we know that because, first of all, we have to presume the judge followed the law as he understood it, and secondly, notwithstanding the substantial evidence that was introduced, the judge, quote, specifically found that no mitigating factors exist in this case. And he didn't, the judge did not say, well, there's evidence introduced and I don't find it mitigating. The judge didn't say, well, there's evidence introduced and I think the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating. He said there were no mitigating factors.
How does this show a misunderstanding?
Well, it shows that in my...
It's a finding. Why does it show a misunderstanding?
Because there was substantial mitigating evidence introduced, then.
No, there's a difference between introducing mitigating evidence and making a finding based on that evidence. There's no summary judgment here in a criminal trial or a sentencing proceeding.
Our position is that given the mitigating evidence, when he made a finding that no factors exist, notwithstanding the evidence being introduced, he must not have understood that evidence because of his narrow understanding.
Well, he didn't think it was mitigating.
He didn't say it was mitigating. He explained what he thought mitigating evidence was when he instructed the jury, and we believe this is evidence that shows that he applied that narrow.
Where did he find this instruction? Instruction on mitigating evidence. I mean, where did the judge?
I think he came up with it sua sponte. It's not.
There's no Indiana case supporting that position.
I'm not aware of any.
Supreme Court of Indiana reviewed the instruction in this case.
Actually, the court didn't, because the court when the claim was raised in post-conviction, it wasn't raised on direct appeal, so it was raised in post-conviction as an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim in post-conviction, and the court found it procedurally defaulted. We argued in our brief that it was an inadequate procedural default. We argued in the district court that as well. The district court addressed the merits. In this court, the state hasn't argued procedural default.
Is there an Indiana criminal instruction, pattern criminal instruction group, book or pamphlet or anything available?
I don't know if there is. We could certainly look into it, but I don't know the answer to that question.
If there is a pattern criminal instruction pamphlet, book, something put out by the courts on pattern criminal instructions.
I can certainly look into that and report
back. You don't know whether there is one or isn't.
I do not know.
Well, maybe your opponent knows.
It's our position that the court here did apply an unconstitutionally narrow understanding of mitigation, and therefore disregarded much of the mitigating evidence that was introduced. And there's a second component to this argument, because it was not only the sentencing judge that made the decision, but also the sentencing jury. And the jury was instructed, it was given the instruction that we've been discussing. Unlike a judge, the jury didn't make any specific findings. So we don't know what the jury considered didn't, but given the instructions, there's a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied those instructions and therefore failed to consider the substantial mitigating evidence that did not pertain to the offense. The Indiana Supreme Court, the district court, and the state have argued that in light of other instructions that were given, it cured whatever inadequacy existed in this definition. Our position is that by defining the term, the central term, mitigating, all the subsequent instructions or instructions that preceded it, that the jury had to follow the judge's instructions on what the term mitigating meant. And so, in effect, that definition trumped the other instructions, because in figuring out what those other instructions meant, the jury had to know. But the judge told us mitigating is limited to facts or circumstances which make an offense appear less severe. So it's our position there was a reasonable likelihood, which is the standard in evaluating jury instruction issues in the death penalty and capital case. So there's a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the instructions to prevent consideration of relevant mitigating evidence. If the court has any questions, I'm prepared to answer them. Otherwise, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. None at the moment. Thank you very much, Mr. Pritchard. Mr. Perkins.
Recognize that at my age one gets forgetful, so I don't forget. Is there an Indiana pattern criminal jury instruction?
Yes, John. There are pattern jury instructions that are published and are available to parties, both criminally and civilly.
I'm speaking specifically of the criminal instructions. Is there one that defines mitigation?
Yes, Your Honor. I do know that there is one now. I'm unaware of whether. I'm sure there was one at the time of this trial, also. However, I can't say from personal knowledge what it said or whether or not it was
adopted before you started to practice law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ah, yes. That's another one of the horrors of getting old. Go ahead.
I would like to just follow up to that a little bit and say that the Indiana Supreme Court did review the instruction and did not find a problem with this instruction in the context of all the other instructions that were given.
Which is the way you judge instructions anyway, in the entirety, not...
Right, and the other thing is that...
I want to know whether there was a pattern in criminal jurisprudence, particularly relating to mitigating a definition of mitigating circumstances.
I'd be willing to say that there was one that met your description. I just can't say right now what it was. I would like to say that the instructions on the direct appeal were covered in detail and that there were issues on appeal that were raised with other instructions. And the way it apparently works, which is standard practice, the court has its own instructions that it gives the parties. The parties review those and then tender their own instructions, and there's argument, discussion about which ones actually get read to the jury. It appears that that happened in this case, and that this instruction was probably part of that packet. So to say that it was sua sponte is accurate in that it was the court's own instruction, but it's unclear whether any objection was raised or whether the parties even discussed it at the time. With regard to
I threw you off your train, so
no, sorry, Your Honor. I'd like to say that with regard to the taking the instruction and then grafting that definition of mitigation into the sentencing order is inappropriate, or at least misleading, in that the judge did in the sentencing order state that the mitigation was proffered and that he rejected it. So it is not as though the judge rejected the mitigation whole cloth or didn't refuse to even consider it. The point is that the judge did consider the mitigation, but rejected it on the grounds that it was not enough to represent something to mitigate the crime or to mitigate the sentence, which is...
I've discovered on the Internet that there are such jury instructions, and Indiana is apparently willing to sell them for $185 a set. I suppose if your hourly rate is high enough, it still rewards the investment.
I was not aware that was the cost of them, but that's...
There's two volumes. The Seventh Circuit pattern jury instructions are available, I believe, for free, aren't they? Maybe that reflects the greater value of the work product.
I was chairman of that committee. I have a deep sense of resentment.
I'll convey that to our librarian. Maybe there's something she can do about that. The one interesting thing by rule is that with the pattern jury instruction, not to belabor this point, a party is able to proffer to tender any number of pattern jury instructions, and then only limited to, I believe, 10 that they come up with on their own. So there is an advantage to using the pattern jury instructions. But that's neither here nor there.
There's a second advantage. The Supreme Court has already reviewed them.
Indeed. That is another strategic advantage. With regard to the competency claim, it's important to consider this from the point of view of the trial judge, where there had been two competency hearings. The petitioner had been found competent, and then during the trial, the petitioner stopped the direct examination at a rather sensitive point after he's gotten out quite a bit of, maybe not exculpatory, but at least mitigating evidence. My recollection of the chronology is that it was towards the end of a day of testimony. They take a break, come back, and the petitioner refuses to come back. At that point, they adjourn for the day. They come back the next morning, and the trial judge brings in petitioner himself, one of the trial attorneys, and Dr. Stewart. So all three of these people are there in the court for the judge to examine as to what has transpired, why the petitioner isn't coming back to testify. So the trial judge very clearly was able to view the defendant post-breakdown, whenever that occurred, and decide for himself whether or not there was enough reasonable notice that petitioner might be incompetent. The trial judge specifically said that he did not see anything to base an opinion that there was any difference in the behavior. The quote is, really, based on what I've seen of Benefield today and throughout this trial, I see no real difference in his behavior. So at a very fundamental level, the evidence was controverted. Dr. Stewart's testimony was controverted by the trial judge's own observation of the defendant. So at that point, there really was a difference of opinion between Dr. Stewart's testimony that the petitioner was now incompetent compared to the prior testimony that the petitioner was competent. The trial judge saw no difference in the behavior, so there really was a difference of opinion between the prior experts and the current expert that testified after speaking to the defendant for just a few moments. The other thing that Your Honor picked up on, this was an effort to manipulate the proceedings. The defendant had an opportunity.
Well, I said that possibility exists. I didn't say that as a finding of fact.
Well, and I didn't mean to mischaracterize your question that way, but that theme is absolutely there, that the defendant, after testifying, after presenting his own view of his mitigation evidence, and even testifying that he did not mistreat the victim, Alicia, and did not keep her against her will, there was no opportunity for the state to cross-examine him on that, and he also was able to avoid testifying about the particulars of these crimes. He was given a free ride, basically, to testify to as much as he wanted to testify about, and then stop. There's no reason to
think... Penny Hirsch tried that once in California. It didn't work there.
That's right. And I think because it is transparent. It's not a sign of a lack of competency. It's a sign of someone trying to manipulate the proceedings and to manipulate the system. Ultimately, as the state court found and as the district court found, this is a finding of fact. The trial judge is free to use his own observations that may be contrary to expert testimony to decide whether or not...
In that last hearing, when the psychiatrist and the defendant and his lawyer were all present, was the psychiatrist sworn to testify and testified to the event?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was on the record. And part
well, of I don't mean it was on the record. It could be on the record. The judge said, if you looked him over, what do you think? But I mean, I want to...
I believe it was sworn testimony, yes, Your Honor.
So he was subject to both direct and cross-examination?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was the lawyer called?
Which
would make it a little sticky, I think, all the way around.
Or
did he just make a statement?
I don't think the attorney was called, and I don't think, for that matter, that Mr.
Bennett... Because whatever the attorney tells the court on the record having to do with the matter there is as good as under oath, so that's...
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the attorney's testimony or his statement was limited to the alleged inability of the defendant to consult with counsel or to cooperate with counsel.
His refusal, I believe.
Well, that's why I said the alleged inability. It's clear that...
I thought the attorney used the term, he won't talk to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's not inability, he won't. Is that what he said? I think that's the quote.
I believe that is right. And so the trial judge was free to take from that the defendant was capable of assisting his attorney, but was making the decision not to. And that supports the finding of competence. The other balancing that the trial judge was required to do was in the nature of the orderly nature of the proceedings, where there had already been two pretrial competency determinations or hearings. One morning in the middle of trial, the defendant has an alleged breakdown. Now the trial judge has to consider whether or not to stop the trial and conduct a new competency hearing that may take who knows how long, certainly several days, if not longer, to get more...
Unless you consider what he did to be a competency finding, because he did. He asked the doctor to testify, he testified.
Yes, Your Honor. And he rejected that testimony. And
he made a finding.
Yes.
That he was competent.
And that he was... to the extent that the petitioner now argues that the competency determination was inappropriate because there was a lack of depth to the proceeding.
What he's suggesting is that the court have to accept the position taken by the doctor.
I accept that, Your Honor. However, the trial judge was not required to accept that and was free to reject it, as the trial court did. The state court determinations supporting or affirming that decision and the district court decision affirming that decision should all be affirmed. If there are no other questions, I cede the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Perkins. Anything further, Mr. Pritchard?
Briefly, Mr. Benefield tries to say the trial counsel did testify at the third conference.
Testified under oath?
Testified under oath, yes. And secondly, the issue of the belief that Mr. Benefield was somehow manufacturing this problem to delay trial, and that somehow this was consistent with a long-standing pattern. None of the other experts ever testified that what Mr. Benefield was doing trying to delay trial. The whole issue is that, again, there was no evidence to support the conjecture that Benefield at any time was trying to delay trial. It is conjecture. It isn't like he had, there's been one of the previous psychologists previously had said, no, he's not cooperating with his attorney because he doesn't want it, he wants to delay his trial. The whole focus of their testimony was because he had a goal in mind. He wanted to die as quickly as possible. And so there's just simply no support in the record for the speculation that this was a conscious decision on Mr. Benefield's part in an effort to somehow get a tactical advantage. Finally, on the jury instruction issue, I spoke with my co-counsel, Ms. Donnelly, who represented Mr. Benefield since 1993 and practiced in Indiana for a long time. And it's her understanding that in 1988 there were not pattern instructions on this issue, but instead what was done would be reading.
That's easy enough to check.
Yeah, reading from the statute. No further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and Mr. Pritchard and Mr. Freeman. Thank you, particularly for your continued willingness to undertake these very difficult cases and the assistance you've been to both your client and the court.
To which I say, amen.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.